We have been studying the text titled Sri Aurobindo Upanishad, and we have seen in our detailed study of the 19 verses that the Upanishad itself is structured in two parts. The first half concentrates on the reality of the world itself being as real as Brahman, because itself the manifestation of Brahman. And the second half dwells on the world as a manifestation of the bliss of Brahman. But there is another way of looking at these 19 verses, and in this one can divide them into three groups. In the first series of verses from 1 to 6, Sri Aurobindo describes the one Brahman and all his aspects, attributes, powers, and the qualities with which, by which, through which he manifests himself to become the world. But it is a description of he. In the second set of verses, from verse 7 through to 11, we find a description of the world that he has manifested, himself as world, and the reality of that world, and the foundation of bliss on which the world rests and from which the world is manifested. In the third set of verses, from 12 till 19, we find the emphasis shifting to the individual soul, the jiva, who himself is the all-blissful divine in disguise, descended into this world, which is itself a manifestation of bliss, and secretly enjoys the play of the bliss. But there is a contrast between this jiva within and the surface person who seems to suffer, who experiences the dualities, and the seed, the root cause of this superficial suffering is exposed, and the means of liberation from that is given, so that we, all of us, can participate in the manifestation of bliss of the divine. Because the world was manifested for his bliss, for his play. When we completed our study of the individual verses, we took a brief detour to two chapters of the Life Divine, in which Sri Aurobindo explores this problem of the delight of existence and its solution. And in that we saw that the whole problem rests on an incapacity of the individual consciousness to receive the full impact of the world, and therefore a distortion and a limitation of the individual experience. And the means by which we, as the normal surface person, can liberate ourselves from this distorted response and recover the divine delight and participate in it. We saw that there are two particular levels where the problem is more entrenched. In the body and nerves, the experience of pain, pleasure is deeply embedded. In the nervous being, there is the habitual response of associating certain feelings, emotions, and sensations with certain familiar experiences. But in the mind, these associations are not so strong, and it is possible for the mind, even from a detached poise, to have an aesthetic enjoyment of even what appears to us as horrendous or horrible. But if this principle is possible at the level of the mind, it is also possible to bring it into the domain of the nervous being and eventually even in the material sensations. And Sri Aurobindo explains how, as a first step, we must train the consciousness to break away from the old habitual response, establish within ourselves an equality of consciousness in all three parts, and then through that equality a passage can be made to fill that neutrality with the deeper truth of the soul's delight. And normally, he says, the passage through equality and neutrality is necessary for human beings. The direct transformation of the triple vibration into ananda is possible, but less easy to the human being. I had mentioned in passing that this suggests that it is easy for the gods, but when the human being ascends through the various grades of consciousness and enters the domain which is natural to the gods, the domain of the overmental consciousness, Sri Aurobindo explains that it is possible to make that direct transmutation also. And I felt that this discussion would not be complete unless we look at what Sri Aurobindo has to say about this from the higher perspective. It is one thing to understand what we can do within this consciousness in which we live, but what is the highest potential that the human consciousness is capable of? What is the destiny towards which all this evolution is moving, and the way in which this consciousness experiences the bliss and the transition to this Gnostic consciousness is described in the chapter titled The Gnostic Being in the later part of The Life Divine, in the last part in chapter 27. Some of what has been discussed before is included here, but I will rapidly cover some significant lines rather than go through the whole text. In my edition here, it is from page 987 onwards. First, he says that once this Gnostic consciousness begins to be established in us, there is a new relationship between the spirit and the body. And so far, what was an impediment to the divine manifestation in the physical consciousness is no more an impediment, and even the body assumes the character of something which is sacred. And even in the activities of ordinary life, we can begin to perceive and even to feel that in the body and generally in all matter, there is that secret divine presence. And even the act of taking food can be treated as a material sacrament, and he refers to the Bhagavad Gita where this is described as an offering of Brahman to Brahman by Brahman. And this is the nature of the experience into which we emerge as we tend towards the Gnostic consciousness. So there is this new relationship set between the spirit and the body. A Gnostic evolution will effectuate the spiritualization, perfection, and fulfillment of the physical being. It will do for the body as for the mind and life. And then he points out how there is in the body consciousness a certain craving. It craves for duration, that is longevity, health, strength, physical perfection, bodily happiness, liberation from suffering, ease. And normally, in most spiritual traditions, these demands of the body consciousness would be rejected as incompatible with the spiritual. But Sri Aurobindo, in his integral vision, gives a very different view. He says, these demands are not in themselves unacceptable, mean or illegitimate, for they render into the terms of matter the perfection of form and substance, the power and delight, which would be the natural outflowing, the expressive manifestation of the spirit. So these demands that the body craves are in fact translation into material terms of realities of the spirit. So these are not in themselves illegitimate. But these become true when they are raised to the character of the truth of the spirit. And this happens when the Gnostic force can act in the body, these things can be established. For their opposites come from a pressure of external forces on the physical mind, on the nervous and material life, on the body organism, from an ignorance that does not know how to meet these forces, or is not able to meet them rightly or with power. So there is the right response which must establish in the body, and also the power of the right response. And both of these are necessary. In the next paragraph he says, it is the incompleteness and weakness of the consciousness force manifested in the mental, vital and physical being. Its inability to receive or refuse at will, or receiving to assimilate or harmonize the contacts of the universal energy cast upon it. That is the cause of pain and suffering. So when the universal energy impacts the material consciousness or even the vital and mental, first we are unable to receive or refuse at will. We do not have that power. Or even if we receive, we cannot assimilate or harmonize. And so the result is pain and suffering. And he explains how in the material realm, nature starts evolution with an insensitivity to begin with, and or a hardness which allows the individual to survive the fullness of the impact. And then as we grow out of this, we grow into greater sensitivity. As the human being grows in evolution, he grows in sensibility and suffers more keenly in mind and life and body, because we have grown sensitive. And so what has to be corrected here? Man has to call in his will, his mental power to dynamize, correct and control his nervous being, force it to the strenuous task he demands from his instruments, steel it against suffering and disaster. But this is the best that mind can do, but it's not able to transform. In the spiritual ascent, this power of the consciousness and its will over the instruments, the control of spirit and inner mind over the outer mentality and the nervous being and the body increases immensely. So as the spiritual ascent takes place, what was started by a mental will, a mental control, a mental assertion, now is filled in with something else, which is greater. And this now he describes, and this is extremely important because it describes the stages through which we pass. As this initial effort of the mental will is filled in by a descending spiritual force. So he says, a tranquil and wide equality of the spirit to all shocks and contacts comes in and becomes the habitual poise. And this can pass from the mind to the vital parts and establish there too an immense and enduring largeness of strength and peace. Even in the body, this state may form itself and meet inwardly the shocks of grief and pain and all kinds of suffering. So at first, this tranquil, wide equality of the spirit settles more in the mind. And there, it can become the habitual poise. From there, it can settle in the vital parts. And there also this immense, enduring largeness of strength and peace can be established. And from there, even in the body, this can come. And from inside, from the inner body consciousness, there can be this ability to bear the shocks of grief, pain, and all kinds of suffering. Even a power of willed physical insensibility can intervene, or a power of mental separation from all shock and injury can be acquired, which shows that the ordinary reactions and debile submission of the body self to the normal habits of response of material nature are not obligatory or unalterable. So even when this grows, at will, the consciousness can choose simply to refuse to be affected by the sensation and even neutralize that sensation itself, or stand back from it and remain unaffected. Both of these descriptions we saw a couple of weeks ago in the text of the Record of Yoga, where Sri Aurobindo, passing exactly through these stages, describes how he is able to walk on the bare stone in the hot sun, where the stone has got completely heated, and he's able to walk on it without feeling the pain, and can even feel a coolness or the touch of delight, or even what would normally be sensations of pain from injury or other material causes. And he is able to be free of them, but also to begin to perceive the delight in them. But these are the result of the spiritual force working in the way he has described here. Still more significant is the power that comes on the level of the spiritual mind or overmind to change the vibrations of pain into vibrations of ananda. And this is that direct transmutation which was referred to earlier. And this comes with the power of the overmind. Even if this were to go only up to a certain point, it indicates the possibility of an entire reversal of the ordinary rule of the reacting consciousness. And so this points to the greater potential when the supramental consciousness fully seizes on the body. And there's another aspect to it which he describes here, which Mother has referred to elsewhere. He says, it can be associated too with a power of self-protection that turns away the shocks that are more difficult to transmute or to endure. The Gnostic evolution at a certain stage must bring about a completeness of this reversal and of this power of self-protection, which will fulfill the claim of the body for immunity and serenity of its being, and for deliverance from suffering, and build in it a power for the total delight of existence. So before the body can experience the full freedom from these habitual responses and participate fully in the delight of existence, it must develop these two things. This power of reversal, which can change the vibration of pain into vibration of ananda by the action of a more overmental consciousness, but also with it the power of self-protection, which can make the body immune and establish in it a serenity of its being for deliverance from suffering. This immunity of the power of the body, the power of self-protection which can turn away shocks which cannot be transmuted. This is what Mother refers to, you will recall, in one of those passages, cryptic passages in the agenda, where she says that the supramental being would have to develop first, manifest his power, his aspect of power, before the other aspects of knowledge and love and bliss can be manifested fully. It will be the aspect of power which he will have to manifest, because he would need to defend himself against human beings. And so it is this, she puts it in a different context, but it is something of this which you see here. There is a possibility in the material consciousness of being overwhelmed by something which is too great. In a very human experience, you can have a large stone fall on your foot, and the stone is so much bigger, stronger, heavier, harder, the foot will be crushed. But such a body obviously would not be a perfected body. A perfected body demands immunity. And it is this which we see in an innate craving even in the body as it is presently organized. It feels it must be able to be free of these things. It must be able to master whatever circumstances are. It must be able to last. It must be able to heal, regenerate, be healthy in spite of everything. And this capacity of the body to protect itself by this power of self-protection to turn away the shocks that are more difficult to transmute or to endure. This power itself has to be established in the Gnostic evolution. And only when that is complete, that there can be the full power for the total delight of existence. Then you could experience the full impact of the universe without any limitation and receive in it the delight. And it is this which we find deep within us as an aspiration, and he refers to this in the next paragraph. An aspiration, a demand for the supreme and total delight of existence, is there secretly in the whole make of our being. But it is disguised by the separation of our parts of nature and their differing urge, and obscured by their inability to conceive or seize anything more than a superficial pleasure. And then he describes how this demand for a total delight of existence translates itself on different levels. In the body consciousness, this demand takes shape as a need of bodily happiness. In our life parts, as a yearning for life happiness. A keen, vibrant response to joy and a rapture of many kinds, and to all surprise of satisfaction. This is in the life parts. In the mind, it shapes into a ready reception of all forms of mental delight. And if this is the translation of this deep truth in the body, life and mind, what happens when we go above mind? On a higher level, it becomes apparent in the spiritual mind's call for peace and divine ecstasy. And peace and divine ecstasy to the mind consciousness are still two different things. As we ascend to the higher ranges of mind, approaching supermind, he will explain later, the peace and the ecstasy become one single experience. But this reality in the body, life, mind, and above mind, of a constant need for or demand for the total delight of existence, this trend is founded in the truth of the being. For Ananda is the very essence of the Brahman. It is the supreme nature of the omnipresent reality. The supermind itself, in the descending degrees of the manifestation, emerges from the Ananda, and in the evolutionary ascent, merges into the Ananda. You see how in the sequence of the involution, there is the domain of the Sat, the Chit, the Ananda, and then the supermind emerges. And then out of supermind, from its self-limitation, mind, life, and eventually matter. But the supermind emerges out of Ananda. And when we ascend through the supermind, we meet once again the Ananda. And so he says, Ananda is the very essence of the Brahman. I skip a few lines. For consciousness, we may say, is its parent power in the spirit, but Ananda is the spiritual matrix from which it emerges and maintaining source into which it carries back the soul in its return journey to the status of the spirit. So the whole world is supported by the Ananda, and Ananda is the matrix out of which the world manifests. I dwell on these lines because they are so relevant to the text that we have been studying from Sri Aurobindo Upanishad. And it is this Ananda which is what he highlights in the whole text. And Sri Aurobindo explains here in the Life Divine that the supramental manifestation would have as its next sequence and culmination of self-result a manifestation of the bliss of the Brahman. The evolution of the being of Gnosis would be followed by an evolution of the being of bliss. An embodiment of Gnostic existence would have as its consequence an embodiment of the beatific existence. So always in the supramental consciousness, in the Gnostic consciousness, there is this Ananda inseparable. Then the last paragraph which we will look at here. It has been held that ecstasy is a lower and transient passage. The peace of the Supreme is the supreme realization, the consummate abiding experience. This may be true on the spiritual mind plane. There, the first ecstasy felt is indeed a spiritual rapture, but it can be and is very usually mingled with a supreme happiness of the vital parts taken up by the spirit. There is an exaltation, excitement, a highest intensity of the joy of the heart and the pure inner soul sensation that can be a splendid passage or an uplifting force, but is not the ultimate permanent foundation. So in the mental consciousness we see this, the ecstasy which the vital parts may experience and even a form of excitement is an inferior truth to the spiritual mind and its peace and its large vast peace. So he says, there is instead an illimitable intensity of participation in an eternal ecstasy, which is founded on the eternal existence and therefore on a beatific tranquility of eternal peace. Peace and ecstasy cease to be different and become one. This is when we transcend above the spiritual mind. The supermind, reconciling and fusing all differences as well as all contradictions, brings out this unity. And so what is the experience? A wide calm and a deep delight of all existence are among its first steps of self-realization. But this calm and this delight rise together as one state into an increasing intensity and culminate in the eternal ecstasy, the bliss that is the infinite. In the Gnostic consciousness, at any stage, there would be always in some degree this fundamental and spiritual conscious delight of existence in the whole depth of the being, but also all the movements of nature would be pervaded by it, and all the actions and reactions of the life and the body. None could escape the law of the Ananda. This is the nature of the Gnostic consciousness when it manifests. But this is still far away, and we can say this is what the whole evolution is driving to. But what can we experience of that Ananda before we attain to this perfection? And so the rest of the passage describes what is possible to be attained before in our current movement of evolution. Even before the Gnostic change, there can be a beginning of this fundamental ecstasy of being, translated into a manifold beauty and delight. And then it describes how it is translated in the mind, the vital and the physical. In the mind, it translates into a calm of intense delight of spiritual perception and vision and knowledge. So there is a calm of intense delight in this spiritual perception and vision and knowledge. When first the mind begins to know the presence of the divine in ourselves, around us, in all things, in the whole cosmos, transcending the cosmos, in this very perception of the mind, there is this deep delight and the calm of that intense delight. Because through that knowledge, there is the vision of the divine, and then through the senses, there is the perception of the divine. We actually, through the senses, see things. We see the flower, and we see in the flower the glowing joy of the divine, which is the form of its beauty. Beauty is nothing but the presence of the divine glowing out its bliss. And we see this with our senses. And with all five senses, we begin to perceive the divine presence. And so in this spiritual perception and vision and knowledge, we have the calm and intense delight in the mind. In the heart, into a wide or deep or passionate delight of universal union and love and sympathy, and the joy of beings and the joy of things. So where mind would have knowledge, vision and perception, the heart experiences the union, love and sympathy and joy. And this experience, even before the Gnostic consciousness is established, this experience is possible when the heart begins to feel the divine presence permeating within itself, around it, in all things, in the whole universe, and transcending. And when the heart relates to that divine presence, it opens out in wideness and feels that presence in its depths, feels the presence in its intensity. So he describes this as, in the heart, that experience translates into. So in the heart, into a wide or deep or passionate delight. And what are the various facets of that delight? Delight of universal union. When you begin to feel the same divine presence in you as in all things. When you feel yourself in all things. The whole world is itself your own larger body. Your heart is a part of the world heart. There is this delight of a universal union. But at first this can be a very general, impersonal sense. So a delight of universal union and love and sympathy. So out of that union there is a universal love. And then there is a universal sympathy. So from the union, there is the pouring out in all the movements of everything pouring into your heart pouring out into everything in this universal union. And because your heart is one with the world heart, well, everything is pouring into everything in love. And there is this tremendous universal love. Again, at first it may be impersonal and later becomes more personal. But the heart strings through which we experience identity of another's feelings, the sympathy which goes beyond empathy also grows in this universality. Again at first more impersonal and later more personal. So the personal dimension now comes as out of the sympathy he describes and the joy of beings. And the joy of things. So at first the heart feels more easily with the feelings of others and the joy of all beings, but eventually it also feels equally that joy in things. We may not recognize the joy in the stone, but we may find more easy to recognize the joy in the flower or in the plant. But eventually we find it is the same joy taking a different form. And in the stone, it is a joy also, and the same joy in a different aspect. So eventually, this is the fullness of the heart experience. In the heart, into a wide or deep or passionate delight of universal union and love and sympathy, and the joy of beings and the joy of things. Next. In the will and the vital parts, it is felt as the energy of delight, of a divine life power in action, or a beatitude of the senses perceiving and meeting the one everywhere, perceiving as their normal aesthesis of things a universal beauty and a secret harmony of creation of which our mind can catch only imperfect glimpses or a rare supernormal sense. So the next is the life energy in its more dynamic aspect. It is the will and the drive of energy. And there it is the energy of delight of a divine life power in action. There are two facets to this experience. The first is this energy of delight, where all that flows we begin to perceive as a flow of the divine energy. Even what appears to us as an emotional, a personal, or a material energy, we see in it the true divine energy of which this is a densified or a degraded or distorted form. And as we begin to identify with the divine energy in things and the divine life power, we experience also its delight in action as everything flows in movement. And in a certain experience, we can say there is nothing which is not in action. Even the inanimate is only a repetitive action of energy flowing round and round. Everything, therefore, is seen as one gigantic play of this divine energy expressing its divine delight. But there is the other side of this experience, which is beatitude of the senses perceiving and meeting the one everywhere. It is a more passive experience. The energy incoming now is registered as the perception of the one and the beatitude of that. And the whole vision now acquires an aesthetic character. This sense of aesthetic enjoyment has two components. It has a component which is more mental, and it has a component which is more sensory, and therefore rooted in the life energy. And in the aesthetic enjoyment, you will find always this drifting between these two extremes. There is an aesthetic enjoyment which is much more sensory, sensual. But there is also an aesthetic enjoyment which is more intellectual and in the domain of ideas. But the full range of aesthesis is included when we span these two extremes. And here he describes the full range and as it enters especially the life energy. Meeting the beatitude of the senses perceiving and meeting the one everywhere, perceiving as their normal aesthesis of things a universal beauty and a secret harmony of creation. And we perceive that secret harmony of creation, but it is secret. The surface forms do not always reveal it, or rather they conceal and reveal in brief glimpses, so of which our mind can catch only imperfect glimpses or a rare supernormal sense. And seen in this way, the whole effort of aesthetic expression is nothing but the drawing out of this secret harmony and beauty into the more outer parts of the form. When you look at it this way, all art acquires a very different meaning. Art is not merely something you create and you form. Rather, it is a perception of something which is hidden behind the surface appearance, and art is the drawing out of what is hidden to make it revealed in the most overt expression of form. The sculpturing is not cutting to create a form, rather it is cutting to remove that which conceals the beauty of the form, and the innate beauty and the innate form was allowed now to manifest. And so the whole nature of this aesthetic experience and the meaning of art changes with this experience. And then in the body, it reveals itself as an ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit, and the peace and bliss of a pure and spiritualized physical existence. The body represents the principle of existence. It is the foundation, the base on which everything else can manifest. So when the body experiences something, it has this character of an innate, self-existent experience. And so when this divine delight is experienced in the body, it reveals itself as an ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit, and the peace and bliss of a pure and spiritualized physical existence. The peace is there, the bliss is there, the physical existence is there, but it has been spiritualized. But it is not living in isolation. Into it is pouring that ecstasy from the heights of the spirit. Now at this point, there's a very important truth that is being pointed to in this pouring from the heights of the spirit. And the truth is this: the triple domain of Satchidananda above is reflected below as the triple domain of the mind-life-body. The supermind becomes mind, the Ananda represents itself as the psychic principle within us, and the Chit Shakti, the power of consciousness, represents itself as the life force. And the Sat, which is the highest of the seven planes, is represented here in the lowest, in the material, sheer existence of matter. And so when this description is given to us, he says, he speaks of ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit. It means at this point, the highest end of the universe is now bridged with the lowest extreme. And the body is the representative of the Sat of Satchidananda, but the bliss of the Satchidananda pours from that highest height into the material consciousness. But the body as it is presently formed, if it were to receive, Mother says, even a drop of the true Ananda, it would shatter. Even a diluted strain of the pure bliss pouring into us leads to an overload of the nervous system, and people lose self-control and begin to dance in a frenzy because the body cannot contain. And so the body needs to undergo a great purification and liberation from its limitations, and that before it can receive this directly. And that's why the three things he describes, and the peace and bliss of a pure spiritualized physical existence. The foundation to receive the Ananda is the peace. And the peace itself must be vast as the universe. Only then it can receive the Ananda. And so, first the peace. And then upon it, the bliss. In a spiritualized physical existence. So the material consciousness itself must have become spiritualized, meaning that the substance of the body should be able to feel the spirit and know the spirit. It must be conscious enough to recognize the spirit and feel itself a condensation of spirit, a part of spirit, and that is the spiritualized physical existence. So in the body, it reveals itself as an ecstasy pouring into it from the heights of the spirit, and the peace and bliss of a pure and spiritualized physical existence. The pure here is also important, and pure in the context of the integral yoga is to respond only to the divine. The purity spoken of here is not of a moral or ethical purity which are only mental constructions and have only a relative value. The purity is when the consciousness responds to no other influence except the divine's. But we say everything is divine essentially or ultimately, isn't it? But the point here is to respond directly to the vibration of the divine consciousness in its purity, in its direct action, not in its indirect, broken, fragmented or distorted action, which is what comes upon us in the appearance of the world. So when everything in the material consciousness responds only to the divine, then we say it is a pure and spiritualized physical existence. So this is the nature of the perception of or the experience of the divine delight as it manifests and reflects, translates itself in the mind, in the heart, in the life force, and in the body. And in summary then he says, a universal beauty and glory of being begins to manifest. All objects reveal hidden lines, vibrations, powers, harmonic significances concealed from the normal mind and the physical sense. So all this, which is the reality of things, which is concealed, now begin to be revealed more and more to the normal mind and physical sense. And so you have a universal beauty and glory of being beginning to manifest. And the result of all this, in the universal phenomenon is revealed the eternal Ananda. So with this we close the digression that we made to the text from the Life Divine. And it is towards this that we have to grow more and more in our aspiration and in our efforts. And the whole text which we are studying is only leading us towards that. With this background, you will see how obviously the text describes the journey to this realization. In the first verse is the recognition of that. Om, there is Brahman alone, the one without a second. And then his aspects. Being and non-being are its forms. And it is also beyond being and non-being. There is nothing else except that. All that is contained in the three times and all that is beyond the three times is indeed that one Brahman alone. Whatever is in the universe, small or large, noble or mean, is Brahman alone. Brahman alone. The world is also Brahman. It is true, not false. Verse 2. That alone is the transcendent being, beyond all the three times, beyond all the worlds, penetrating all the worlds, beyond being, beyond non-being, all being, all consciousness, all bliss, without beginning and end, the eternal divine. So gradually from that, where the transcendence was emphasized in the first verse, there is now the transcendence and the permeation, the immanence. And then verse 3, in four steps, how he manifests the qualities and yet remains free of them. He is without quality and supports all qualities. He has qualities, infinite qualities, and enjoys the state of being without quality. He himself transcends the state of being without qualities and the state of being with qualities. He is neither without quality nor with quality because he is one and alone. Verse 4. Now all the powers by which the world is formed, time, space, multiplicity, etc., are introduced. He is beyond the worlds, yet he holds the worlds. He becomes the worlds and enters into them. He transcends time, becomes time. Infinite, he shines as finite. One, he becomes many. Formless, he assumes forms. He achieves all this by his consciousness force, which consists of knowledge and ignorance, vidya and avidya. Verse 5, he himself is neither holder nor held, neither infinite nor finite, neither one nor many, neither formless nor formed, because he is one and alone. Verse 6, all these are but names. That which is called oneness and that which is called multiplicity, that which is called infinite and that which is called finite. All these names shine out indeed in the world, whose very self is consciousness, and which consists of consciousness alone. And from this point, the emphasis shifts from him to the world. Verse 7, Om. The Absolute, That, Tat, Sat. And that which is existence, the same is consciousness. The world constituted of consciousness shines out in the spirit, which is consciousness. It is the real light of the real divine. Verse 8, as the reflection of the sun is one in calm water, but multiple in restless water, real is the sun, real the reflection, the real light of the real sun. It is not a dream, but the light of a reality. Or, as the light of the sun shines, filling the solar world with its force, as if running, real is that light, the real luster of the real sun. That is not false shining, but a real luster of a reality. Or, as the flaming disk of the sun is not the sun itself, but this material form only manifests the sunness of the sun to our knowledge, which is dependent on the material being. The sun is beyond that form. Real is the sun, real the form in the shape of the disk. It is the real light of the real sun, not illusory, but the real light of a reality. So three images were given, this, and in the same way the world shines out from Brahman, he says. Then the verse continues, similarly here the world Brahman is the true light of the divine, not a dream, nor illusory, nor a false shining. It is the real light of the reality, not the divine in himself, but still he himself only. This is the supreme Maya, creative power. This is the greatness of the yoga of the mysterious Lord of Yoga, Sri Krishna. This is his blissful Leela with his consciousness force. This is the inconceivable working of the Supreme. And verse 9, which, having seen the reality of the world as a manifestation of the divine, looks at the problem that mind faces of the reality and unreality. All this is phenomenally true, but false in reality. This is for the satisfaction of the mind's perspective. For the comprehensive knowledge, that is the supramental knowledge, it must be said that there is nothing unreal in the real Brahman. Verse 10, whatever thus manifests is the world bliss only. And from this point, it is the emphasis of the bliss which flows from this halfway point of the verses. But still, the world description continues with bliss as its foundation. Verse 11, Om Tat Sat. And that which is existence, the same is consciousness. And that which is consciousness, the same is bliss. As for that which appears as devoid of bliss, as suffering and weakness and ignorance, it is the deformation of that bliss, the play of bliss. Verse 12, and now the emphasis shifts to the individual and his bliss. That indeed which is Jiva is the all-blissful divine in disguise, descended to enjoy the self-luminous world Brahman. This, which is the experience of suffering, is an experience made of bliss. The all-blissful enjoys its bliss only. Verse 13. Who indeed could dare enjoy that which is devoid of bliss? He only could dare it who is all-blissful. As for him who is devoid of bliss, he, while enjoying the blisslessness, would still not enjoy it, would rather perish without bliss. Who can become weak? He only can who is all-powerful. The weak one indeed, invaded by weakness, would not endure, but would perish without force. Who could enter ignorance? Only he who is omniscient could enter it. As for the ignorant, he could not endure in that darkness. Non-being would remain non-being only. It would perish without knowledge. Ignorance is the play of knowledge, concealing itself in itself. Weakness is the play of power. Blisslessness, the play of bliss, the concealment of itself in itself. You see, in a single verse, so many, such profound philosophies concentrated and condensed. Verse 14. Blissfully laughs the Jiva, blissfully cries, sheds tears, blissfully throbs as if shining in dark ananda, agitated by tortures, blissfully throbs, agitated by violent pleasures. For the full enjoyment of the dark, ignorant portion of ananda, the Jiva conceals it, becoming obscure and ignorant. So now the obscuring of the ananda is chosen freely by the Jiva, and verse 15 explores this experience. Verse 15, ignorance is the root of the idea that I am but finite and therefore incapable, weak and sorrowful. I have to act, know and achieve with labor at the expense of energy, incurring mortality. Thou art that, I am this. That which thou art, I am not. That which is good for thee is bad for me. I lose by that which thou gainest. I shall be happy only if I kill thee. I am not at all so illumined and happy that I may make thee happy by my own suffering, by my own loss, and by my death. Etc. This is the form of ignorance in mind. And we saw in our deeper study how these are steps by which we emerge out of the ignorance. And what happens when we emerge? Verse 16. Ego is indeed its seed. By deliverance from ego, one is delivered from ignorance. By deliverance from ignorance, one is delivered from suffering. Knowing that I am all blissful, he am I. I am one. I am infinite. I am all. One becomes all blissful. One becomes a being of bliss. Verse 17. This alone is liberation. The liberated one enjoys the enjoyments of all. Enjoying all joys infinitely, he is not separated from finites. He is not bound to finites. Enjoying finites, he is not reduced from the infinite. He becomes one, he becomes many. Although unborn, and is as if it were born. Even being born, he is not born, is not bound. He has no birth. I, the self by self am radiating self. By this knowledge liberated, he plays. And now the play of the world is emphasized, the full manifestation of the bliss. Verse 18, for Leela, play indeed, is the world. He has become playful for joy. Therefore be engaged in Leela, O sons of bliss. Being united, play, enjoy the bliss. Having attained the one enjoyable divine, enjoy him in all things. Verse 19, as commanded by the divine, I shall only expound the bliss. Removing obscurity, radiate the bliss, you who are its children. So with this we complete our study of the text titled Sri Aurobindo Upanishad. And from next time, I propose to take up a study of a very special text which Sri Aurobindo describes as at once the most obscure and profoundest of the Upanishads, which offers peculiar difficulties to the modern mind. And this is the Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad, the Great Aranyaka. It is a fascinating text in which Sri Aurobindo leads us to changing our mind's outlook, to begin to see the world through the intuitive consciousness. And the text describes the whole universe as the sacred horse. And in that symbolism, the horse of the worlds is an intuitive vision of the cosmos as the body of the divine, which we will begin from next Sunday. For now, we can meditate on the text that we have read for a few minutes.